Are you writing that down? Are you putting that in your notebook?
It's spelled B-O-C-C-E.
You know, they have a similar game over here. It's not called Bocce. It's called Shoot the Bull.
I'm Andrew Riley, and this is Drupal Easy podcast number 61. Today with us, we have Mike Anello, who happens to be in Belgium right now. How's it going, Mike?
It is going well. Thank you.
We also have Ryan Price, who I know you won't believe this, but he just bought a set of bocce balls. How's it going, Bocce Ball King?
Excellent. According to my dad, we have to drink Chianti while we're playing bocce, but I don't know. Wow, this is not that kind of a neighborhood. So
is this your first set of bocce balls?
It is. And actually, it was a quest because we tried to go to the sporting goods store, and apparently there they sell the professional bocce sets, which cost about 8 or 10 times as much as I paid for mine.
Would you get you could pretty much go out and find 4 big heavy rocks and play bocce.
Yeah. These are they're made of resin, so very geeky sort of plastic.
Awesome.
Wow.
Well, congratulations on getting your first set of bocce balls. It's a big moment in a young man's life.
It's a good excuse to have a giant patch of grass in front of your house.
There you go.
And we also have with us Rick Shreves, who is a founding partner of Water and Stone, and he's also the author of a plethora of technology books and, guess what, a bunch of Drupal books. How's it going, Rick?
Very well. Thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on the show.
So as you've probably noticed lately, we've been having guests. And when we have guests, those guests are usually our first topic in the 5 topics or 5 things that you thought we would talk about. So I guess, Mike, you've actually gone through the latest book from Rick, right? Drupal 7 Themes?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I should say this is our first podcast where we can literally say that we have somebody on from the other side of the world.
it's true.
Yeah, Rick, you are located in Bali, Indonesia, which is exactly 12 hours ahead of, I'm going to say us, but Ryan and Andrew today, 12 hours ahead of U.S. Eastern Daylight Time. So yeah. And I'm actually 6 hours ahead of them. So if we only had someone 6 hours behind, I guess that would be Hawaii. We can kind of surround the earth with Drupal. For the podcast.
Multi-continental.
We are. Look at that. Yeah, 3 continents. I guess is Bali considered Asia?
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, what were we talking about?
Drupal 7 Drupal. Themes.
So Rick, this is your third Drupal theming book, right? You did a similar book for Drupal 5 and Drupal 6. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
So with each version, how do you approach, or how did you approach, the book for Drupal 6 or for Drupal 7? Are you scrapping what you had and rewriting? Are you just kind of adding on, or kind of what's your thought process to getting the new versions out?
Well, I mean, Pact approached me about the Drupal 5 themes title, quite a while back. I mean, I just really started out working with the Drupal in 4.6 or 4.7, I think it was. And to be honest with you, most people, I think, that start with Drupal, I found the theme layer really tough, right? It was really a struggle, particularly since I'm coming at it from more of a designer side or even a systems analyst side. So it was a bit of a struggle getting my head around it. And so when they approached me about the book, I thought, I'm going to do this because it's going to be a good chance for me to polish up some skills and figure out what in the world is going on here. I love the system, but why does it look like that? So the Drupal 5 book was really a struggle for me. Then when Drupal 6 came out with the changes in the theming layer, it all became a lot easier. And that book, Drupal 6, inherited a lot from Drupal 5 because, there were some important changes, but it wasn't, earth shattering. There were some things that came in from that first title that though really I felt probably should go away. So when Drupal 7 themes came around, I junked a lot of it. I junked a lot of the old approach. I changed the focus of the book. I got away from long code examples, which I really feel are pretty much pointless, but it was sort of the standard that was passed to me when I started things out. went with much shorter examples, stayed more focused on how to do things, how to accomplish things, instead of getting bogged down in the minutiae. And there's a lot of minutiae in there.
Yeah, it seems like, well, first of all, thank you for mentioning Pact Publishing. I don't know if Andrew, if you did it at the top, but I want to thank them, of course, for hooking us up with Rick to get him on the podcast. You know, the one thing I noticed about this book before we like start diving into, you know, some of the details is it really is focused on, you know, someone who is either new to Drupal theming or has dabbled in Drupal theming, because you really do spend a lot of time talking about theme functions, overriding template files, and overriding CSS, and kind of how they all interact with each other. And I have to assume that that was kind of intentional. I mean, or is that kind of just the way things ended up?
No, it's pretty intentional. I mean, you know, the audience for a commercial publication, right? Mm-hmm. It's a factor. It's a consideration. And there's a lot more people who are at that end of the theming spectrum than are at the other end, you know, the theming ninjas out there. And frankly, you know, the theming ninjas don't need me to tell them how to, you know, do those things. So, you know, there's a target market, and those books are aimed at that target market.
Absolutely. All right, so you know, just I'm going to do a quick overview of some of the different chapters. Maybe we can touch on a point or two about each one. You know, the first, you know, two or three chapters are kind of what you would expect from, you know, from a theming book. Kind of, you know, what is a theme? What does a theme do? How do you find new themes for Drupal? And then kind of a theme anatomy. You know, an info file, a template file, template files, I should say, CSS files. In the fourth chapter, where you start, you know, introduce, you know, overriding CSS, overriding existing templates, and overriding theme functions. I got to that chapter, and as I'm going through that, it really felt like you were laying the foundation, you know, for the rest of the book.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I think for anybody doing theming with Drupal, I know that when I was first getting into theming, I'd learn maybe a little vertical slice here and a little vertical slice there and a little vertical slice over here. And it took me a while before I had a really good base knowledge. And I think this chapter really, really provides that. Is that kind of what you were going for?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. That's exactly, I think, most people's experience, right? I mean, you know, yeah. How much of this do you know? Well, I know what I had to do to get through the last project.
Yeah.
I know what I had to do to solve that problem that was making me insane last week. So the first three chapters really are baby steps. You know, like you said, this is what it is. This is what it does. Here's how to find another one. But then you really lay that foundation that says, now, if you want to do more, you know, more than what you can accomplish with just, you know, clever configuration and content management, this is how you should approach it from a best practices point of view. And here's the concept. And that's what chapter four really does. I mean, that's when the book's content starts to get interesting, you know, for people who are really interested in doing more with their themes.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent chapter, even for, you know, people. And I want to talk about, you know, these labels in a second, but even more for like intermediate themers. Because it really does, it provided me just a confirmation that what I thought to be true was true as far as how everything interacts.
Yeah, and I mean, it's good that you say that, because I think what I tried to accomplish with these books, even from the beginning, was getting it out of being a series of isolated discussions about particular functionalities or particular aspects of the theming layer, and try to put it into something that was more of a big picture, that, you know, sort of synthesize that knowledge into a fashion that it was meaningful as sort of a, I guess, you know, I hate to say philosophy, that sounds pretentious, but, you know, sort of a way of approaching the problem.
Yeah, there were definitely, as I was going through the book, there were definitely times that I was going through it saying to myself, wow, there's not a whole lot of examples. I wish there were more examples. But then, you know, the discussion, though, like you said, it's powerful if you stick with it and kind of follow it through to the end. Even though I was kind of wishing for examples, by the time I got to the end of it, I feel now, looking back, that I actually gained a bit of knowledge. And I've been doing theming, it sounds like, about as long as you have, since Drupal 4.7.
Cool. Thanks for saying that. I appreciate it.
Sure. So I want to jump ahead to another chapter. You're talking about creating a new theme. And this, you know, this is kind of segues into an article, into another story, but we're going to have to jump around a little bit. You know, creating a new theme. And you had a little brief discussion there about choosing a base theme or possibly starting from zero. And not having any base theme whatsoever. I mean, is there a time? I mean, I've been using base themes for a long time. And I think Andrew and Ryan, you guys are the same one. I don't think. Have you guys built a theme from scratch without a base theme lately?
Yeah, actually, I'm a purist in that sense. But I also then throw out to, you know, some of the grid ones or a Zen or something like that.
What do you mean throw them out?
Well, I actually use them sometimes. It really depends on the project that I'm doing and how much of that extra weight I need.
Okay. How about you, Ryan?
I have been actually using the Omega theme quite a bit, but I think like anywhere where you're starting with a base, like even with Drupal, you know, you kind of have to mold your brain to how that developer thinks.
Right.
So there are frustrations with it. It's not perfect for everyone, but for the most part, I build from base themes.
So, you know, I thought this would be an interesting place. And maybe we can jump to this other story. And then
sure, let's do it. It makes sense at this point.
Yeah, so this is the story from Wiredcraft. Let me click on this link here just so I can actually see. I want to attribute it properly. Sending to... Come on.
By Ronan Berder.
Thank you. Yeah, Ronan Berder, who I think I've actually met. I think I actually met him in San Francisco. If the picture looks like the same guy, but he argues against using, and the key word here is most, starter and base themes. So it's actually kind of an interesting article because he talks about why we don't use starter themes. And then at the very end of the article, he says, well, we actually do use Tao.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So it's like,
and or Dao, depending on how you
Dao. Yeah. Oh, it is Dao. Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me. So I thought it was kind of an interesting article, but the comments just kind of blew up. You know, some people were saying, well, base theme gives you so much, or, you know, it adds bloat. So Rick, kind of where do you fall in this discussion? I know in the book you kind of talk about, you know, there are some instances where you can forgo a base theme. And what do you recommend when you're talking to people?
Well, I mean, the article really is fine for what he says, but it should probably be titled something along the lines of why I prefer this specific base theme, right? Yeah. And, you know, as you ask people this question, you know, you do get different answers, right? Some people are using Omega. I use Fusion now and then. You know, Zen, hey, it's great. Everyone, it's been around forever and ever. And so they have a place. I think that in the context of, you know, a web development studio that has house rules and has standard builds, you're probably going to adopt a standard that works for that development environment. And for some people, that's going to be, okay, hey, we build on DAO always. That's where we start from. At our office, for example, we build on Zen. Okay. That's just the way it is. That's what we train everybody on. That's what we have everything set up for. Our snippets are ready to go. Boom, boom, boom. It knocks it out. It expedites production. But if it's a situation where, you know, I am super concerned about performance or I'm planning to release the theme back into the community, well, you're starting from scratch. That's the way it's going to be done. But I think that base themes are a very convenient tool with high utility value. And I think for most people, and now we're backing into sort of that target market for the book. Yeah. I think for most people, you know, a base themes approach to creating a custom theme is the way they're going to go.
So Ryan, you do a bit of training, and Andrew, you too. I mean, is there a time when you guys are teaching theming that you say, here's an example of when you shouldn't use a base theme? Or is it purely one of those things where we're really talking about more advanced users who want to squeeze every last drop of performance out?
Well, when I'm training, I will, especially theming, I'll do two different examples. One is, you know, start from the base theme. Normally I use Zen because of the documentation. And I say, okay, here's a Photoshop document. We're going to try to make Zen look like this Photoshop document. The other example I do is we go to like open source web design or CSS Zen Garden or something like that. We find existing style sheets and graphics And generally there, I'll just start with a core, with a flat theme, you know, or Stark, which is really the same thing. You know, start from kind of that Drupal core base and then just build on top of it. Because the idea there is to get, you have this existing HTML, maybe it's a designer handed it to you, or it's the old website, you're migrating it, and you just want to get it up really, really fast. You may miss some of the things that a base theme hands you, but you know, you could always steal the template PHP from another base theme. The problem with any time you copy code out of somebody else's module, if they update that code, if they find a security flaw in their code, if they, you know, fix it so that it's more compatible with Internet Explorer version 9 or whatever the heck it is, you're not going to get a benefit from. One of the reasons why I use open source is because I don't have time to keep up with every single little thing that changes out there in the world. So I kind of distribute some of that responsibility to other people. I pay the price for it sometimes, but a lot of times it ends up being a great benefit and a huge time saver and more secure and more stable.
Ryan, those are great points. And it really hits right at the heart of what I was saying too, that it really is sort of a cost benefit thing, right? It's like, you know, hey, this may not be the world's most ideal solution, but because of the benefits it brings, it makes perfect sense in this case.
Yeah, totally.
Although I do recommend that everyone at least try starting from scratch at least one point to get a good, and your book goes over some of the, or most of these points, but just to get a good understanding of how some of those theme overrides happen. And there's just a lot of stuff that those, you know, starter themes tend to handle for you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, if you really want to, like, you know, get comfortable with the system, you need to go through that exercise at least once, right? And, you know, and walk into the wall and figure out what the heck happened and why you don't want to do it this way or that way. When I originally wrote that chapter was initially focused entirely on building a theme from scratch using Stark as the base. I mentioned that because Ryan mentioned that a sec ago. And I actually trashed it about halfway through, and I said, you know, from a purist point of view, this is, you know, it's a good didactic tool. I can build some lessons off of this, but in reality, nobody's going to bloody do that. So I think it was kind of interesting to hear Ryan say that.
And the other thing is, I've heard this thrown out in Twitter lately on multiple fronts, is does this kind of make a space in Drupal for a themer and then a skinner? Not skinner the theme, but a person who's, you know, just using something like Xen or Omega and not actually delving into the theme, but just changing some CSS.
Interesting. That's a debate that's happening in our studio right now. And I'm on the side that, no, there really isn't a place for that because you need that deeper understanding and you need the ability to handle, you know, the conditional logic. And my production manager is firmly in the camp of, no, we want people who just focus on the CSS and let the developers handle, you know, the TPLs.
You know, whenever I meet a themer who doesn't want to do anything but CSS, the answer is very simple for me. It's like, you can make a lot more money on an hourly basis if you can override theme functions, create new templates, than if all you do is CSS and images. And for 80% of the people I talk to, that's enough to get them motivated, to be perfectly honest. So, all right, moving on. So the next chapter I want to touch on is chapter 7, and it's kind of where you start talking about multiple templates for a page. You can have one just for the front page, just for a certain type of content, blocks, or a block that appears in a certain region. And this was kind of the first instance in the book where I saw something that I said, oh, that's new in Drupal 7. And it's something I already knew about, but I wasn't, as I went through the first half of the book, I wasn't looking for things that weren't in previous versions of Drupal. You know, you briefly talked about the HTML template file and the region template file, and that's kind of what caught my eye. And I got to thinking about the first half of the book that I had just read, and I'm like, you know, you didn't really make a whole lot of distinction between 6 and 7, what was new in 7. And I don't know if that's a criticism or not, but it just kind of struck me as interesting that, wow, I'm through half the book and here's like the first thing that I know for sure is new in Drupal 7. I mean, is this something that, again, was this a conscious decision, or were you just writing the book, you know, for people who were new to Drupal, you know, regardless? Definitely
wasn't a conscious decision. I think there's a few call outs in the early chapters, probably in chapter one, that says, hey, these things are new in Drupal 7. I vaguely remember writing something like that. To be honest with you, I couldn't tell you exactly where it is, but it's an interesting comment.
Okay. So do you think, and you know, so my other, you know, I guess question off out of this chapter was, you know, and it's a question or a topic that we've talked about before on the podcast is, you know, Drupal 7 does a heck of a lot more than Drupal 6. In addition, the code is stronger than it was in Drupal 6. But there's a lot more code, and that kind of raises the bar for new developers to get involved. Do you think the same thing could possibly be happening with the theme layer? Because of the theme layer is doing so much more now, and you can do so much more, and there's these additional templates, you know, the two that I mentioned as well as some other ones. Do you think that raises the bar for new themers?
I'm going to give you a wobbly answer. I'm going to say yes and no. On the surface, yes, it does, because it increases the intimidation factor.
Sure.
But but the reality, once you get over that and you dig in a little bit, is that, you know, you can do as little or as much as you want. And the theme layer is quite logical now. I really think they're doing a great job of making it more functional for people. And I think that, you know, if you wanted to dig deeply and get into preprocessors and things like that, it's there for you. You know, that's available for those people. But for the vast majority of people, that, you know, if there's no reason that they would have to dig that deeply. And if they can focus on what they need and stay, you know, in that area, if you will, I think it's pretty accessible.
All right. No, it's a wobbly answer, but it's not a bad answer.
Thanks.
But Ryan or Andrew, were one of you trying to jump in there? Did I squash one of you?
Not I.
Okay, very good. All right, so the next chapter, you know, something I haven't seen your first two theming books, so it may have been in there, but you have a whole chapter dedicated to theming forms, which I thought was fantastic. And this is one of the few chapters I felt we really dove a little bit deeper. You touched on, you know, hook form alter and hook theme. And hook theme, I think for a themer is, if you can understand not only what hook theme does, but when to use it, that kind of puts you in the, you know, high, intermediate, or advanced bucket of themers. I mean, what do you think about that? And how do you, how do you approach, you know, teaching hook theme?
Well, I think you're right. It does put you in sort of a different class. That chapter, the chapter on forms, is by far the most difficult chapter, version after version, for me to have to write. I find the theming of the forms to be really non-intuitive, and I find it to be quite difficult to work with. And I think the reality is, from all the different studios that I've seen, a lot of people just don't do it. They'll plug in web forms, or they'll plug in something else, and they will bypass the whole damn problem. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, frankly, because the amount of time that you have to spend dealing with the forms is really sort of it weighs against any kind of, you know, time development line, right?
Right.
So I tend to encourage my guys at Water and Stone, you know, it's there. If you need it, let's get into it. If we want to explore alternatives, like web forms is a common solution for us, then let's get into that and let's use it. And, you know, and let's get through the forms portion of this thing. We don't normally find very many situations in which we absolutely positively have to dig that deeply into theming forms in the Drupal core. So we tend to stay to sort of narrow our exposure or limit our exposure to that whole area of theming in the name of expediency.
Yeah. And I had some more questions about hook theme, not really questions, but, you know, things we can talk about, but I think I'll wait, you know, maybe till next time we talk, because that's one, you know, function that I've, over the years, I've struggled on and off with. And actually, just this past week, I was, you know, I had to implement, I thought I had to implement a new pre-process function, in a theme for something that didn't have a template file yet. And one of the things that you hammer home in the book is if you're going to use a pre-process function, you have to have a template file. You can't have the former without the latter. But anyway, I mean, I said that correctly, right?
There are some options, but as a matter of best practice, yeah.
Okay. All right. Close enough then. So just to kind of wrap up what was, you know, the rest of the book, you know, there's a whole chapter on, kind of common theme issues, you know, when you're theming, if you come up across, you know, white screen of death, or if you come up with cross browser theming, not so much as here's what you do, but more of here are some ways to get some clues on how to fix it, which I thought was very handy. And you even have, you know, my favorite part of any, you know, electronics user manual is the troubleshooting table. You know, when this is happening, check these four things. So I thought
there's just so many there's just so many variables, right? I mean, it's really hard to say, oh, well, you need to do X, Y, and Z, and that'll sort you right out. But you know, pointing people in the right direction is bloody useful.
Exactly. Go ahead, Andrew.
Any of the troubleshooting items is the final fix, drink a beer?
It should be. That's Drupal 8 theming right there. Right. You also, in that chapter, you also cover, you know, a little bit of views theming, a little bit of panels theming, which was obviously, you know, I like to see that stuff because that whenever I'm doing theming, invariably I end up having to override a views template for one reason or the other.
Yeah, I would actually love to be able to write a lot more about that. But that's one of those areas where, you know, it's not in the core, and we're trying to stay focused on what you're doing with the core. And, you know, it's going to appeal to a segment of that audience, not perhaps everybody. But God, you know, it's an interesting area, and there's fun stuff you can do there. But it's a big, big topic as well. I wouldn't be surprised if PACT winds up with another book on that at some point in time.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where in order for people to really be able to take advantage of it, they need to have the foundation that you lay out in the book. So it's hard
to do. Yeah, it's building blocks.
Yeah. Okay. And then the last chapter, you know, it's a big list of helper modules for themers. A lot of these, as I was going through the chapter, I'm like, yep, we use that, we use that, we use this, we use that. You know, I learned a couple new ones as well. And I know that you have one of them as your pick of the week a little bit later, Rick.
That's right.
So, you know, I think the only two I'm going to mention are conditional style sheets, which I think we've had a pick of the week earlier. And this is something where if you need a style sheet just for IE7, this module kind of lets you or provides a mechanism to do that, you know, relatively easily. As well, another one that caught my eye that we use all the time is semantic views, which we've talked about all the time on the podcast. Yep. All right, so that's all I have for the book, I think. I mean, it's definitely a really good read for, you know, people who have dabbled in theming, people new to theming, or even I would say like low intermediate level themers, just to really cement your foundational knowledge. So check it out. You know, you can go to PACT, and the link will be in the show notes.
You know, looking at our stories today, we are going to be very theming heavy, but I think that's a good thing since the Drupal community is very developer heavy. So,
and you know, and we have like a theming expert on with us. So,
well, no,
know.
I mean that's a double good. Yeah, double good. There we go.
There you go.
So next up, we have a story about Drupal and HTML5.
All right, can we go to number three first? Because I got to get something to drink because I've been talking a lot. Okay. Sorry.
Well, I'll go to number three then, which is one of my stories. It's about Document or Die. That's an abbreviated title. It's actually Moving Drupal Forward. It's Document or Die, and it's by Chris. I don't know if Chris has a last name. So basically what Chris is saying in here is that, you know, Drupal's documentation isn't great. He says the core documentation isn't bad, but the problem is contrib. that right now a lot of modules, and I fall into this, don't have documentation, or they'll have just a paragraph of geek speak that, you know, most users aren't going to understand, or it's not going to help most users ultimately. Now, what do you guys think about the state of the contrib documentation? Have you guys run into any less than stellar examples that you think the community should really pick up its game?
You know, I think there's lots of examples of bad documentation on Drupal.org. But I think for the most part, if you know where to look, you can usually find the information you're looking for. I think it's one of those things where the people who write the code mm-hmm. aren't necessarily the best people to write the documentation.
Oh, I would agree.
Yes.
And,
exactly.
And that's a real problem, because in a perfect world, you'd have a team. You'd have one person writing code and maybe one person writing the documentation. But in reality, that rarely happens. So I'm just thankful that I can find the nugget of information I need. Maybe it's in the README file. Maybe it's on a separate handbook page. Maybe it's somewhere in the issue queue. But, you know, I'd say 9 times out of 10, it's there somewhere.
Yeah, but, well, yeah, the thing is, it makes it harder for new users when they're looking for a nice turnkey solution, drop in a module, have everything magically happen. So I'm all for more documentation. But I guess here's where I put my money, put my mouth where my money is documentation is probably one of the easiest thing for Joe Average out there to contribute. You don't have to be a programmer. You know, if you think you have a better way of saying this than what's in the current documentation, you could just probably, you know, put it in there in an issue. And, you know, me as a maintainer, I would be more than happy if people wrote my documentation for me.
Yeah, but
can I point out too, like, there's at least two different ways that we're spelling out the word documentation here. One is like almost like tutorials or explanation documents on Drupal.org in the Drupal handbook. The other one, which seems to be what this guy, Chris Cohen, is complaining about, is the inline code documentation that appears above each function or at the top of each file. And those two things are very different.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Their intended audiences are completely different as well. And that inline comments, they should be succinct, they should be accurate, and they should be, you know, economical on the whole. But, you know, really, the whole issue about documentation, the problem is certainly not unique to Drupal. A lot of the open source projects suffer from this. Joomla has the same problem. And what happens is, you know, the people that are able to write this in a prose fashion that's understandable by the average user who wants to know, you know, why would I want to use this? You know, what will it do for me? Those people are not going to devote their time to doing documentation. History shows this. What happens is that publishing companies step into the breach. And this is where we wind up with books from Wiley and Pact and Rocks and all those sort of thing.
No. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is that, like you said, this is not a problem that's unique to Drupal. You know, this is a problem with the vast majority of software out there. And I don't think that, well, part of the solution, I think, is asking people to contribute, like Andrew said, it's a very easy way to contribute. But you can ask people till you're blue in the face, and that's not going to solve the whole problem. I kind of like, I'm struggling to come up with the example. Is it Stack Exchange or one of those sites that you submit a question and then everyone else can vote on what the best answer is? Is that
Stack Overflow?
Stack Overflow. Thank you very much.
I thought you were going with Yahoo Answers. Phew.
Oh, okay. No. but I think from a, you know, and I believe, and again, I'm pulling things out of thin air here. I think it was, is it Lisa Reichel who maybe a few months back, she put up that mock-up of a module page and some usability changes.
Yeah, we probably
changes.
Even did this as a story on the podcast.
Yeah, and so she, you know, it was all about usability changes. And one of the usability changes on that was as people post issues and give answers to issues, you can, you know, hit a little, you know, plus or minus button to give that issue or to give that answer more weight. And that's actually not a bad, you know, a bad addition to documentation. you know, if the community had something like that to say, here's something really helpful for this module. It may not be in an actual, you know, official documentation handbook page. It may not be in the code, but it's captured and it's there. And if there's some way to kind of pull that out or highlight that, I think that, you know, that goes along and adds to, you know, the pile of documentation.
Mm-hmm. So, I like it. I think it's clever.
To bring it back with what Ryan was saying, though, most of this article is talking about the actual code documentation. But
yeah, but I'm ignoring the actual code documentation, just talking about what I want to talk about.
Okay. So. But I still think what you said at the beginning of this article holds true. Sometimes the worst person to be documenting their own code is the author.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where when you're writing code by yourself in a cave, you know, and you're just writing and like you take little shortcuts here and there, and you know, you might document, you know, here's a function that does something magical with a little smiley face. But the minute that you know that someone else is going to be looking at that code, mm-hmm. you're going to start, you know, cleaning things up a little bit more and, you know, second guessing yourself and, you know, making sure that code is, you know, where it needs to be. And, you know, I think it's, you know, it'd be great if everybody had, you know, kind of like a buddy. If all module developers had a buddy who not only looked over their code, but would add the documentation and maybe pick the developer's brain saying, so tell me again what this function does and I'll write up two sentences and that'll be fine. And, you know, in a perfect world, that's the way it would be. But here in reality, you know, it's hard enough to get people to write like a 10-step how-to.
Yeah, very true. But they want new features.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we need.
Okay, so just to give Chris proper credit, I found his last name. It's Chris Cohen, so you can check out his post. There's a lot of comments, and you can join in the conversation as well, or in our podcast notes at drupaleasy.com/podcast. Okay, so now back to Mike's story, since you've had a drink of water.
Yes, it was iced tea, but thank you.
Well, yeah. And one more thing, too, is like, mm-hmm. This may be an indication that we should have, you know, Ariane or Jennifer Hodgden or some of those documentation people on the show as a guest in the future.
Absolutely.
Public call. That's all I got to say.
Well, we could have, who was it, Tom Geller, who said we should burn it all down? Because we should definitely have him on the same podcast.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
A very special episode of Drupal.
Ding, ding, ding. See, I wish I had music for that. Damn. Yeah, so this it's the next story, as you were alluding to, another theming story, Drupal and HTML5.
Yep.
And the article is, you know, it's by Scott Bell. It's not a super meaty article. It just basically says, hey, Drupal's going towards HTML5. Here's where you can get some more information, and here's a theme where you can start implementing some HTML5, you know, into your everyday themes, along with a couple, you know, paragraphs on, you know, real beginner stuff for HTML5, which is kind of why I like this article. It's got a little bit of everything, and it's not so long that you get lost in the details. But I did pick this one out, you know, mainly because Rick's on the podcast, and I don't believe there was a whole lot of HTML5 talk in the book. And I just
no, there's not. There's not. I realize also when we were writing that book that, you know, Drupal 7 was still going through development and a lot of the modules were really lagging behind. We had been following the HTML5 tools module, you know, which does provide some enabling functions to let you build HTML5 themes rather easily. Unfortunately, at the time the book was written, it wasn't ready yet for Drupal 7. I'm just looking at it here in my browser right now. It's still not ready for Drupal 7. It's still in dev, which is not a good sign. you know, it's still really a bit of a struggle for people that want to get heavily into the HTML5 side of things right now. There is an HTML5 base theme out, but it also is in fairly early development as well. So, you know, there's a bit of, you know, some of the people in some of the other projects, some of the other competing projects are poking fingers at Drupal 7 saying, oh, it's not HTML5 ready. You know, we've got HTML5 templates, et cetera, for our system. And, you know, it does take a bit of work. It's a fact.
So why don't you, I mean, let's talk about, you know, real briefly, just in a sentence or two. I mean, give us like an elevator description of what is HTML5? And what, well, what does it mean?
What does it mean? What does it mean to
big question.
Does it mean to the public? What it means to the public is more responsive web design and better rich media experiences across platforms is what it means to the public.
Okay.
What does it mean to the developers? Well, it's a new standard. It means there's going to be a bit of learning involved, and there's going to have to be some changes in some habits. There's going to have to be a real emphasis on semantic web and the ability to put together proper semantic pages. Otherwise, you're going to have real problems when you go across platforms and devices.
I mean, can you compare, I mean, when assuming that HTML5 is, you know, is part of Drupal 8 core from the outset, I mean, how big of a change is that going to be for Drupal developers to kind of grok what's going on? Is this going to be something that's similar from, you know, all the changes from 6 to 7? Or is this going to be kind of a sea change where you have to reteach how to do theming?
I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal, personally. Sorry, Rick.
No, I agree.
I mean, I think the core themes, like the base themes and things like that, you're going to start to see a lot more variation there. In, you know, one of the biggest things that changes in HTML5, like, sure, we get a video tag and an audio tag, and we get new form field tags like a telephone number tag and an email tag and all these different things. That's not really that big of a difference. It's just, it's codifying things that we're already doing as web developers. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that are different are like the section tags and where you use headers and where you use sidebars and navigation tags. And like, there are all these new things, the quote unquote semantic ways of laying out the page that so far nobody really has a great, like there's nobody out there that's been doing this long enough that they can say, if you ask me, this is the best way to do this. And I think one really good place to look for that is on alistapart.com. Mm-hmm. You know, those guys are tend to be kind of leading the way, and they get some of the best and brightest people out there. So some of the people that are sort of like, you know, front runners of the web, but still there's no like right way to create an HTML document. Like right now you'll see people talking about, oh, well, people who use too many divs or people who, you know, do whatever it is. There's a bunch of different ways to use this. And all HTML5 did is they dropped a whole new bucket of extra tags in our lap that we can do it completely the old way with, you know, if you go really, really far back, tables or divs. But now we have all these extra elements of ways of like grouping things on the page. I think that's one thing that's going to be something that's very different going forward in the web. But the form elements and the responsiveness and the interactivity and all that kind of stuff is like, it's great. And hopefully Drupal will be able to do some of these other cool things like WebSockets, which right now we have Ajax and AHA, which basically says you can click something on the page. The page doesn't have to reload, but stuff on the page can change. I think the idea with WebSockets is you don't do anything and stuff on the page can still change. And there's more of a standard for that kind of stuff. And we could do 7 different shows about HTML5 and we still wouldn't cover it all.
Right.
Yeah. And even like you were saying, some of those experts, I had a coworker that asked about the section tag and the article tag, about which one is basically comes first. It's not a chicken and egg joke. And the guy said, I actually have no idea. It doesn't really matter. So you can have articles in your sections and sections in your articles.
I think that's absolutely true.
It's a less high maintenance of a language, so you can focus on other things, I think, overall.
So is there going to be an issue, you know, when sites start deploying using HTML5, is there going to be an issue with older browsers looking at those sites?
No.
Yeah, of course.
Well, most sites use the HTML shiv. So as long as you use something like that, you can get around most older browsers. Now, IE6 is always going to have its IE6 issues, but they're not going to be directly related to HTML5 for them.
Well, and this brings us to one of the links from our show notes, which is the roadmap for HTML5 in Drupal initiative, apparently led by, oh, I don't remember who it's led by now. Okay, there's a name here on the page. It says Jacine Luisi, but I don't know if that's technically who's in charge of the initiative.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
Okay. And so
double check one of,
point number one on phase one is implement JavaScript fallback for non-supported browsers, which is what Andrew's talking about. That's the very first thing they want to make sure is that they don't break backwards compatibility. So I think that's definitely something that is on the brains of the person in charge of the initiative. And I think if you want to be involved, it's pretty easy to, I don't know where the best place is off the top of my head. Is it, on Drupal.org? Is it on groups.drupal.org? Is it to get involved with the HTML5 tools module?
I'm
not 100% sure.
You are correct with it. Jacine is the initiative owner.
Okay.
In Drupal 8 for HTML5. And there, if you can go to groups.drupal.org/HTML5.
Excellent.
I think 1H, because I think I just stuttered there for some reason. So it's not HHTML5, just HTML5. I'll stop talking.
Okay. And so for our next story, we have, well, I don't know where to start on this one. It's all about Firefox 6. Ryan, it's your story.
Firefox 6, yes. So just a few weeks ago, it seems, Firefox 4, hit the shelves, and now we've got Firefox 5 came out recently, and I just got an update on my browser today. I think I'm on the beta channel, so it says Firefox 6, and I was like, it feels like this is happening so fast. So there's actually a whole bunch of new stuff that's happened in Firefox sort of since 4, and we don't talk a whole lot about browsers here, but I figure this was a good story. There's so much new stuff that we could talk about a little bit of it. So the first thing is, Mozilla, the people at Mozilla, they realized that the web is changing pretty darn fast now, especially because of some of this HTML5 stuff that's being developed, and it's really actively being developed. So, for a little while, Firefox was saying, well, we're only going to support Aug video. But then Google said, well, but what if you had supported VP8 WebM video too? And they're like, yeah, actually, that's a really good idea. So now if you have a Firefox browser, you can play Aug audio, Aug video, or WebM video right inside the browser, no plugins required, which is really neat because on my mobile phone where I have the Firefox browser, it works exactly the same way. And I was able to play some videos inside my browser without like going to a separate application. So they put out this roadmap and they said, this year we will release Firefox 4, 5, 6, and 7 inside of 2011. And they sort of laid out, we want to work on these kinds of things first. We want to work on these kinds of things second. And they're trying to solve some problems that browsers haven't necessarily tried to solve before. Like keeping your information organized, keeping your identity organized, helping you store your information, making sure that you don't lose any of your information, because increasingly so, browsers are starting to be almost like little databases, and they keep stuff for you. So one example would be your bookmarks, but there are other examples too, because now websites can basically install a database on your browser. Like I was looking at my browser preferences today, and it says, mobile me, the Apple email service, has stored almost 2 megabytes of data on your computer. And I'm like, what is this? What are they storing? And it's probably something about my email or my photos. I'm not sure, but they're using a little bit of my hard drive to, I guess in theory, make my experience better. So there's all these different things that are going on in the web. And I thought that we could spend a little time talking about browsers.
And that number shift, I think, is an interesting thing, because I think Chrome was the first one to put it out, but Firefox is now moving over to it. Essentially, the version number of browsers is going to become irrelevant soon. It's more of, it's just a feature set. It's just a browser. Although, total side tangent, while we're talking about browsers and versions, IE10, on their latest post on the IE development blog, they've cut out conditional comments. So no more if IE less than 7 use this CSS. So I sure hopefully got it right for 10.
Hopefully that means that they're committed to doing things, quote unquote, the friendly way.
IE9?
Well, 10, you say, right?
Yeah, I know. But IE9, they were supposed to be, back in the good guy space again.
Yeah. And I mean, so far from what I can tell, they are. So hopefully that, this is just the next step in that commitment where they say, we're so confident that we're doing things a friendly way that we don't need to play nice anymore. You know what I mean? We don't need to like give you this extra back door, because none of the other browsers necessarily have this. Every browser has a couple of things that are browser specific, but
Yeah, I hope we don't need the workarounds for their issues.
Yeah. So one thing that's changed recently in Firefox is actually some developer stuff. If you use Firefox, you're probably very familiar with Firebug, which is an extension that lets you do all sorts of stuff with the browser, inspect things on the page. One of the things that I found it really useful for was it has this JavaScript console that basically lets you write JavaScript inside of a little window, and then you can run it on the page. In Firefox, one of the recent versions, let's say 4, they introduced a new tool called the Scratch Pad. Basically what this is, it's a little JavaScript file that sort of like sits off to the side, and you can have it run on any web page. So that whatever web page you're looking at right now, you can either run the whole entire window, or you can highlight a little bit of the code, and you push, you know, your whatever your command key is, command R, control R, and it will run that code based on the page that you're currently looking at, the tab that you currently have open.
Well, that sounds a lot like the what's that plugin for Firefox?
WebMonkey?
Yeah.
I thought it began with, I want to say that Garage something.
GreaseMonkey.
GreaseMonkey.
Yeah, it was close.
Yeah, isn't that kind of like a...
It's very similar.
An ad hoc GreaseMonkey type of thing.
Yeah, so the idea here is you can have a file that you just sort of start, you know, writing ad hoc. You feel like, oh, I need to write a little bit of script to do something on this page.
Right.
Or you just, you can load a file that you already have existing. So this is really good for just spitballing things, prototyping them. I would like to see this happen for CSS as well. I think it's just for JavaScript now.
Well, I would make every link blank on the page.
Oh, no.
I miss the old days.
And this is really a developer tool, whereas GreaseMonkey is a little bit of an end user tool,
right?
Albeit a power user, geeky end user tool. But this is really for you're doing some development, you want to test something out. So they have the Scratch Pad, and then they sort of have now their own built-in console. And one big difference, and one of the key benefits they listed was, the console is always sort of quietly running in the background. Mm-hmm. It's just a log of all the stuff that's happened on the page. So if you are having a problem, like with a client, and they say, oh, well, my browser didn't do this right, you can say, all right, open up this panel, and you tell them, you know, push this key combination, or go to the tools menu web developer, and just copy out the messages from the log, email them to me. Because their browser's already collecting that information. And I was like, oh, well, that's a really good benefit. They don't have to install any plugins. They don't have to restart their browser. They can just open it up, whatever state it's in right now, grab the log messages and go. And there's a JavaScript function, or there's a JavaScript object, the console object, which is really similar to like Drupal print message, where, you know, console.log this or console.error this. And you can write to that log all the time. And your client doesn't know that you're doing it until you say, can you open up your log? And I've already put a bunch of debugging data in there without you knowing it. So send me that stuff. I like the idea of it.
Yeah. The console.log is awesome. I use that all the time. The, you know, the other thing, I'm looking at the link you have here for changes for web developers, I think is, let me see what the name of the link is.
Yeah. It's like developers.
Yeah. Firefox 6 for developers. I like the fact that HTML5 has a progress element.
Definitely.
Basically a progress bar.
Yeah, this task is now 50% complete, but it's like themable. So you can make it look however you want instead of having to write your own little whatever.
I predict we will be overrun with progress bars soon. Very, very soon.
I need progress
bars. Well, and now are we going to go back to preloaders for web pages? So like... You know, you get a little animation going, and then there's a little robot dancing, and then
Please,
it says 50% loaded, you know.
Oh, that's good stuff. I like that.
Yep, definitely. Okay, excellent. So now it's time to talk about our sponsor, Web Enabled.
Yeah, what are we going to – it's kind of funny because Andrew left something in the chat a few minutes ago about what are we going to talk about on Web Enabled today?
And can we stick with a theme, and the theme being themes?
I love it. Let's do it.
Okay. Web Enabled is integrated with a website you may have heard of called Top Notch Themes.
Ah, yes.
And if you buy a theme from Top Notch Themes, this is sort of a mini commercial for Top Notch Themes, who does not sponsor our show. Top Machines has a whole bunch of web-enabled distributions. So basically what they do is they say, you can buy this theme from us and instantly have a website running this theme with some sample content running on web-enabled within a matter of seconds.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
That's a really cool little benefit for, you know, you just spent maybe it's $200, $300 on a theme, and now you want to show your boss, hey, this is what we bought. You don't just have to show them like, welcome to your Drupal website. You can actually show them stuff with, you know, sample Latin content in there.
Yeah, and that works. I mean, that's that works great with top-notch themes, but anybody can do that. That's not some super secret code that's out there. It's just that top-notch themes decided, you know what, we're gonna put all of our themes on web-enabled, and they do have, there is some sort, okay, I suppose there is a little bit of top secret code that gives only certain people access to those themes, but I mean, that's kind of what web-enabled does. They make it very easy to get a site up and running, configured in standard configurations.
If we go back to the discussions we were having about the quote-unquote Drupal App Store, web-enabled is a really early implementation of that. You know, you can put up these distributions for free or for sale, and that's one of the ways that Top-Notch Themes is making this work, is they're using that ability to package up a Drupal site and give it to you.
There you go. So check them out at webenabled.com.
All right. Now it's time for our Picks of the Week. Each podcast, the host choose, it could be a module, a theme, a book, really anything that we think you would, or that would help you. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Mm-hmm. So, Mike, why don't you start us off this week with your pick?
Oh my gosh, we could do a whole show on this pick based on the wrestling match that I had with this topic. So I picked the taxonomy block module, which is a nice little module. Basically, what it does is it takes a vocabulary that you have on your site and it prints it out in a block. And that's basically what it does at its heart. It's very simple. It only lets you do, you know, one block with one taxonomy. The reason why I chose it is because if it's a hierarchical taxonomy, it will print it out hierarchically, which I think is a word, right? It'll show you the hierarchy when it prints it out.
It's a world, or it's a word in my world, which doesn't really mean much.
It doesn't. Should I explain it then?
No. Or, I mean, we good? That if I say it's a word, I don't know if that really counts for anything.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay. Well, it's, you know, now that I've said it, if we say it like six more times, I think it's officially a word.
Okay.
But it's by this guy, Yuri Babenko. I believe he's from Moscow, I believe. I'm going to look that up actually, if one of you guys can look that up, I'm pretty sure I saw that.
I'll look it up.
Okay, thank you. But I picked this because it got me out of a pickle that I was in, where we had this huge taxonomy that was, a hierarchy in nature, and I needed it displayed somewhere. And I assumed, and this is on Drupal 7, I assumed that I would be able to go into views, create a view of terms, and have that view print out showing the hierarchy.
Not so well, no, much.
You cannot do that.
Yes.
And I assumed all along that you could. Granted, I never tried it. So when I couldn't get that working, I said, well, maybe there's a module that provides a view style plugin that will show me the hierarchy. Nothing for Drupal 7. So then I started panicking just a little bit, going, well, how the heck am I going to display this taxonomy? And not only that, I didn't want to show the whole taxonomy. I just wanted to show a subset. I wanted to pick, you know, one term and just show everything underneath it. So eventually I found this taxonomy block module, and I had to hack it and make it my own, because I actually needed two blocks with one taxonomy but two different starting points. But I wanted to bring this up because I feel like this is one of those things that I can't be the only one looking for this. And I'm just wondering if, I mean, you know, the three of you guys, you know, Rick, Ryan, and Andrew, what would you guys have done? Would you guys have kind of taken the same path that I did to solve this issue?
Silence.
Hold on, wait.
Yeah.
Wait.
Uh. I've actually run into a similar problem, but I never found this module, and I ended up having to essentially write a little mini dirty little module for me to use.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's not fun writing those queries to get the inheritance.
Yeah, I mean, this almost, you know, if we weren't so late along in this project, and Ryan and Andrew, you know the project I'm talking about. If we weren't so late along in this project, I was seriously thinking, well, maybe I should have created a menu tree rather than a taxonomy hierarchy with this stuff. I actually went so far, I was looking at modules that automatically convert taxonomy into menus. Oh. But that quickly got, you know, I came to my senses before I did that. I guess, you know, I'll wrap up my pick by saying this module solved my problem. It, you know, I had to write maybe 10 lines of code to get everything I needed. But I think there's an opportunity here for someone who wants to make a little bit of a splash in the Drupal community to make a Vue's plugin, style plugin, so you can output a hierarchy. And I know it's tricky.
Yeah, it's going to be a very tough one.
Yeah, and actually, Earl, oh gosh, everybody drank. I said Earl. I thought we were going to make it. Damn. I actually found, you know, some issues in the massive Vue's issue queue. And, you know, just those people, I forget what Earl calls them, the people who help maintain the issue queue, those people are doing the work of God. They are, God bless those people. Everybody should buy not only Earl, but I forget what he calls them, but the
thralls. No, I don't know.
The issue queue maintainers, the whatever thralls. They are. Yeah. Anyway, there were some issues with Earl going, wow, that's going to be very tricky to do that. But
you should call them stormtroopers. Whatever he calls them now, he should change it to stormtroopers.
They are now stormtroopers. But regardless, it's one of those things that I know I'm not the only person who has come up against that and threw their hands up. But I think it's one of those issues that you don't realize you have until you have it, if that makes sense.
And then you.
I'm really glad, Mike, that. Yeah. I'm really glad, Mike, though, that you did point to this module, because I had something really similar. You want to show the current taxonomy term and things that it belongs to and its children, and yes.
Yeah,
I feel your pain.
I was so, and what, you know, it was first just utter surprise and shock that I could do it like easily. I'm like, I have to be missing something obvious. I'm forgetting about a module. I'm doing something wrong. And, you know, I had the mandatory 3 hours of banging my head before I came to I realized, wow, I guess there is no easy way to do this. So.
Andrew, I've got a nominee for your Module a Day podcast screencast.
Uh-huh.
Taxonomy block.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the funny thing is, a project I'm working on right now, I'm like, oh, this module exists. I'm going to use it. So it just solved my problem.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, another potential, tweak or suggestion for aspiring module developers is get involved with the taxonomy block module and make it more flexible. Make it so that, you know, the module is basically, I don't want to say hard coded, not the right word, but only supports one block. I know I only needed two. So I basically, added another, you know, switch in one of the hooks to get a second block. And I added another text field in the settings in order to get the starting point where you have to enter a term ID. It's not very pretty, but literally it was 15 lines of code. I had what I needed. It'd be a great addition to the module to let you choose the number of blocks as well as the starting point for each one.
Yep, so. Those would be very, very handy. And for our Drupal trivia folks, while Yuri's name is very Russian and he speaks Russian, he lives in Canada.
He's a Canadian.
Yes.
Excellent.
Okay, so let's see who's next up. And Ryan, you're next up on the pick list.
Okay, so this is like a podcast crossover episode right now, because I was listening to one of my favorite shows, which is called Floss Weekly. It is an open source show, not necessarily a Linux show, which I guess some people who listen to it, they think it should be more of a Linux show, but they cover all kinds of stuff. They have, unmanned aircraft. They have model trains. They have Mars rovers. Actually, those things are all pretty related, aren't they? and sometimes Drupal modules, apparently, on the show. Huh. And this is Floss Weekly number 172, hosted by two of their sort of regular rotating hosts, Aaron Newcomb and Dan Lynch. And I know they're both Drupal users, so if you guys are listening, we will love to have you on the show. This is my official second, I guess is my second call out to potential guests. But they had Travis Tidwell on, who I believe, Mike, we've had on the podcast before.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. I will look that up while you're talking.
Travis Tidwell lives in Texas, and he works for the guys that do the Little League Baseball thing. Which the name of it I cannot remember right now.
Oh, those are very, we should have those guys on the podcast.
Definitely.
That is, it was more than just Little League Baseball. It was, sports leagues.
Oh, and
there you go.
And Travis was on episode 26 of Drupal Easy Podcast.
Oh, he wrote the Flash book.
That's it. Yep.
There you go.
Publishing. Yeah.
So that's right. I remember this.
Is like a big stirring around because Aaron and Dan also have their own podcasts. And then this is a like podcast friendly module. It's called Media Front. Finally getting to the pick part, which is called Media Front. They did almost a whole hour talking about this module, and it's essentially an HTML5 playlist module. You can integrate it with views. So you pull out a bunch of, nodes or media elements out of your database with views, and you can have them play one at a time. You can have them display a playlist. I think this had a former incarnation as a different module, but it is now called MediaFront. And he also says you could download the player and use it separately outside of Drupal if you really, really wanted to, but it's really kind of optimized for using with Drupal and dealing with views. So definitely really interesting to check out. It does audio, it does video, it has a Flash fallback if your browser doesn't support that. So this is a really cool module that's definitely worth checking out. And you can go listen to a whole hour-long show just talking about this module and how it got developed and sort of Travis's history in the world of open source and tap dancing.
Tap dancing. All right.
That's a teaser for you. Go listen to the show.
Links will be in the show notes, as always.
Yep. And my pick of the week is the achievements module. Now, this, I haven't used it yet, but when I found it, I was like, wow, I just need to find a site I can use this on. It's basically emulating the Xbox 360 achievements. So for those of you that aren't in the video game world, in Xbox, if you get 10 headshots, you then get an achievement. If you give 100 people a flower, you might get an achievement for that.
I know all about achievements because I play Plants vs. Zombies.
Do they have achievements in there?
Oh, God. This game, I almost need to get rid of it so I could become more productive. But the nice thing is I have my kids addicted to it as well, which I'm not sure if that's good or not. Yeah, but there was an update, I don't know, maybe a month, 2 months ago, maybe more, I don't know, where there's now achievements. So,
So it's a... sorry.
No, it's addicting. I mean,
Yeah. Well, you could do that to your website, though. Imagine if you made an achievement for contributing Drupal documentation. Or, yeah, having modules or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great way. I mean, I'm living proof. It's a great way to get people coming back.
Yeah.
Because
there should be an achievement for uninstalling modules.
Now, I like this module. The only thing is it does require some custom code to create your own achievements. What I'm hoping is that this module will go in a rules-based direction so people will have a lot of common rules that they could use to give achievements without having to code.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, if this module gets any traction, that'll probably be one of the first things that happens.
Yep.
So, is rules integration.
And finally, I can turn websites into video games and my world will be complete. Okay, Rick, and what is your pick of the week?
Well, I thought we'd stick with the themes theme that we have going this week, so I've pulled out one of the handy-dandy theme-related modules that we like to use called @FontYourFace. which basically is a way to simplify using the font face declaration to pull in web fonts for your site. Integrates with Typekit, Google Fonts, Font Squirrel, and fonts.com. Pulls the whole catalog in. You can browse it directly from inside your admin interface. Elect what sort of which of the fonts you want to use on the site, then install those. Takes care of copying the font files over onto the server for you. Takes care of adding the declarations into the system so you can use classes to place these into your content. It's bloody useful. It just simplifies the whole font face declaration and makes it open for anybody.
This does something that I think more Drupal modules should do, which is to let you browse like a catalog from your admin interface of stuff, whatever that happens to be. Is it Flickr photos or YouTube videos or fonts? I really like the whole like user experience, at least from the description. I haven't actually used this module yet, but sounds like a really great idea.
It does depend on views to produce that, but I mean, you know, it's not a big deal for most people. But it is pretty slick. It works quite well.
Yeah, there's if you click on the documentation link, there's actually a slideshow, a screencast showing it. Yeah, it's slick. It's I've never used it either, but I, you know, it's one of those things where I can definitely like see myself, you know, the next time I have to like do a mock-up or something, or have to choose some fonts, it's maybe even just sitting down with the client and going through them in a very, you know, quick and easy way.
Very good. Okay, so this week we don't have a site of the week, but you can always submit them at, I hope I get the URL right, drupaleasy.com/site of the week.
You got it.
All right. Hey, I've been off the clock for 2 weeks now. We're lucky I remember my own name.
There you go.
Okay, and if you want to follow us offline, you can always stalk us on Twitter or on our website at drupaleasy.com/podcast. Now, if you are on Twitter, you can follow us at Drupal Easy or myself at Andrew M. Riley or Ryan under the 2.0 spelling of Liberator. Mike is Ultimike. Also, our great sponsors, WebEnabled, are just that, at WebEnabled. And our guest of this week, Rick, is, wow, Rico Flan. There we go. So a special thanks to Rick and Pact Publishing for coming on to our show this week. I'm Andrew Ray.
Thanks, Scott.
This has been Drupal Easy Podcast number 61.